tonight on Arena. We relook at George Orwell's 1984, 75 years on, and Queenie and Lost Boys and Fairies are our TV shows for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. It's TV night, and this week's TV, the BBC's Lost Boys and Fairies, is the fictional story of musical artist Gabriel and his accountant partner Andy and their difficult and emotional path to adopting a child. Next up, Queenie on Channel 4, based on the best-selling debut novel by Candice Carty-Williams, which won the Book of the Year in 2020's British Book Awards, making her the only black author ever to win that prize. Queenie, played here by Dionne Brown, is a 25-year-old British-Jamaican South London journalist who we meet during a relationship crisis with her boyfriend. And finally, we have Becoming Karl Lagerfeld, a biopic of the key decade in the life of the German designer who famously ran Chanel in Paris. This is a six-part series. It's based on Raphael Bacquet's book Kaiser Karl and tells the story of his life prior to his Chanel tenure when Lagerfeld was a freelance designer. The story focuses on the rivalry between Lagerfeld and Yves Saint Laurent, especially in their love for a young socialite writer. So first up, we'll take a look at the three-part series on BBC One, Lost Boys and Fairies, written by Daph Williams and starring Fa Free as Andy and Cian Daniel Young as Gabriel. So, Chris, when we meet Andy and Gabriel, they've been together for 8 years. Yes. And they want to develop their relationship and adopt a child. Well, at least one of them does.
Yeah, yeah. They want to take their relationship to the next level. They don't want to get married because, as Gabriel, played by Cian Daniel Young, says, it's a little bit too heteronormative a move. But adoption seems like a natural progress because one of the guys, Andy, played by Fafi, he really wants to become a parent. So we meet them at the beginning of this adoption process, which involves a social worker, played by Elizabeth Barrington, as his character Jackie. She's brilliant in it. She sits down with them in their home in Cardiff and she starts off with the all-important question, why do you want to adopt? And Andy wants to, you know, almost right the wrongs of his past, and we delve a little bit into his background and his missing father figure, and he was raised by a single mother played wonderfully by Maria Dolla Kennedy, and he wants to, you know, start a family, raise a child and just, you know, have that next stage of the relationship with Gabriel. For Gabriel, it's a little bit tougher, and he is struggling to suppress this intense trauma and pain he experienced as a child. His mom died when he was just a toddler. He was raised by a very strict, a very religious father who wasn't very accepting at all. That's just an understatement of his upbringing, or the fact that he's a gay man. He had addiction problems when he was younger. There's an awful lot of trauma and pain there, and he seems to have it all under control. He says several times that, you know, Andy saved him, and he thinks that, you know, he's hopeful that he might be a good father, but he might be also fooling himself. So basically we go through this adoption process with the two of them. We go through with Jackie, and we also learn a bit about their background as we go along.
Yes, we learn a lot about Andy's background, Jen, but we don't learn an awful lot about Gabriel because he just lies all the time.
And I mean I think that's a good mix, and I think as a couple they do have that necessary chemistry between the two main actors, and I think one is using the other as a shield, as in Gabe is kind of pushing Andy, who's more charismatic, I'm more upfront, to actually go out there and charm Jackie basically and get them to get the adoption over the line, whereas he's a lot more reticent and he's dealing with a lot of these demons. And we, as Chris said, we go into his mind basically, and you're dealing with, like, it's shown in this almost head spinning montage of everything that he had to deal with in his life. Like, it's all about his identity, whether, like, identity being queer, but also identity, national identity being Welsh, and it's about his fear of getting older and his fear of what a child could potentially do to their relationship, and confronting his past and dealing with his own demons, his ideas around perfection in a child and a parent. Like, he's not exactly a likable character either, and I think that's one of the strengths of the show. It is showing you what we're trying to conceal from each other, what we're trying to kid ourselves as well with, the person that we present to the world and the person that you want to present to the world, like, as this father figure, but also who we are underneath it all. And you can see that coming through in very hard scenes to watch where, you know, Gabe is saying that he doesn't want a child that's disabled or differently abled, and they're going through the list, and Andy is like, oh my God, you're so harsh. Like, I mean, how can you do this? And he's like, I only want a girl as well, because boys are trouble. And it's all about the trauma that he has gone through, and it's about, you know, unearthing that and excavating that. And like, that makes the show a very intense watch as well.
As you say, as he begins to excavate all the problems that have made him the person he is, Gabriel then begins to unburden himself to the authorities, and Andy isn't very happy at that. So in this clip, we have Andy, played by Fra Fee. He's angry with Gabriel, who's played by Sun Young, because he's told the social worker about his past wild life of drink and much more. And there's some strong language in this clip.
What the hell did you go and tell her all of that for? The last time was years ago. We dealt with it. You sorted it out. You know what your boundaries are, right? You never get drunk. You never touch white wine or Prosecco. There's no problem anymore. Exactly. So it doesn't matter that I told her, does it? Grow up, Gabriel. Of course it matters. The only reason kids get adopted nowadays is because their parents are too fucked to look after them.
So that's Fra Fee there and Sign Young. That relationship between the two young men and then the social worker. At the beginning, you feel you're almost watching a play, or you're a fourth person at the table.
That's true, yeah.
You know, in these, they're not interrogations. She's very soft-mannered, but she is watching, and she has a particular way of listening to what they're saying.
Yeah, and you're on Andy and Gabe's side at the beginning, and then when Gabe starts to lie, you're over onto Jackie's side, and by the end of the first episode, they're a team, and and Jackie is rooting for them, and she acknowledges too, there's a lovely conversation between Andy and Gabe. It's very honest about the adoption process and how knotted and complicated and contradictory it can be. And there's a lovely conversation between Gabe and Andy where Gabe points out the obvious, that most couples, if they're lucky, they have sex, they have a baby, and that's it. They are parents now. They don't have to go through hours upon hours of interrogation and interviews and these kind of like mock therapy sessions to see whether or not at the end of the day they're suitable, you know, to be parents. So it is a very cruel process, but Jackie, you know, tells them halfway through it, I'm with you and I want to see this happen. So in that regard, it is kind of one of the most honest dramas that I've seen that takes us through that process. And it might sound as if it's a bit you know, like, oh, it's showing us a little bit too much. But there are these lovely montages where, for instance, when they do actually find a boy that they have a connection with, and Gabe is actually surprised that it's a boy because, as Jen said, he wants a little girl. There's this lovely montage that takes us through the trial process of how, you know, they have to go into his life and get comfortable with it. Then they kind of take him for a day, maybe half a day. And it does all of this with a lovely musical score too, because there are quite fantastical elements to this. It delves into Gabe's job as a performer, and it uses that to tell the story as well.
Well, I don't have a clip of that montage, but I do have a clip of when Gabriel and Andy meet and greet potential adoptees, children that they might adopt. And when they think they're alone and start to gossip and then have a sneaky kiss between themselves, they don't realise that there's a young boy hiding beneath where they are.
Come on, let's do one more round. It's like being back at school and no one wants to play with us.
That's how I feel. Hi.
How long have you been there?
Since lunchtime. You do swear a lot.
Well, we didn't think anyone else was in here.
I like spying on people. Are you gays?
Sorry?
Because Claire told me there might be gays here. But I've never met a real one before.
Ta-da! Claire, is she your foster carer? Is she around anywhere?
When you kissed, it sounded like you were slurping a giant ice lolly. Ugh, it was disgusting. I had to put my fingers in my ears. Do you have any lollies?
No.
Sweets.
No.
You're not trying very hard because some of the others have sweets. You need to bring sweets if you want us to like you. Fairy Godmother has sweets. She's a massive twat.
That's Leo Harris, the young boy. And this, Jen, is the young boy who comes into their lives.
Mm, he is. And I think that is the most... I mean, it's a very charming show in that way. And it's devastating to watch, I have to say. Like, it is absolutely heartbreaking and you will cry. There's no doubt about it. Like, I mean, in that first episode, when they're attending this open day for the adoption agency and they get to meet some of the children there, that's especially heart-wrenching when you see it's like catalogues of children all begging for a home. Like, and I think that the show offers that in-depth look at this process that is so difficult for so many. And I do think that Leo Harris, as Jake, really equips himself as a sturdy little actor for sure, and is, you know, good enough to stand with the two main characters. But it also, it brings Gabe's own kind of worries and scars from his own childhood to the fore, looking at this young boy. And I think, you know, in episode two, I thought it strayed a bit for me because I think the opening episode is so striking. Then it kind of goes back onto course in the third episode. But I did wish for a fourth, almost in a way, because I think they needed to let those characters breathe a bit and give them a bit of space. It's a lot, you know, to contend with in just 3 hours, and I think you needed that extra one just to make it more complete for me anyway.
So for you, Jen, a stars out of five for Lost Boys and Fairies?
I'd give it 3.5.
3.5. And from you, Chris?
Yeah, I don't think it's not very often that we sit here and ask for more of a series, but I would have happily watched more of it. And I thought its playful sense of humour too worked really well at that open day that Jen mentioned. There again, there's this lovely sequence where Gabriel just imagines the parents as these superheroes just beating the heads off one another in order to get the attention of kids. So I thought that punctured the drama so well. There's a lovely lived-in chemistry between the two actors, between Fra Free and Sian Daniel Young, and I just thought the kid was brilliant. It did turn me to mush at times too. So it gets an extra star for that. So I'll go 4 out of 5.
Oh, I give an extra star to see you turning to much too, Chris. Next up, a new situational comedy from Channel 4 called Queenie. And Queenie is portrayed here by Dionne Brown, the 25-year-old black woman who seems to be suffering a quarter-life crisis with work and romantic relationships in chaos. Jen, Queenie is Candice Carty-Williams' much-loved book. And of course, it's wonderful that it's being brought to the screen, but that's also a precarious venture. She's also involved in, the author is also involved in the writing.
She is, and you know, that's a surprising element to it as well. In a way, I thought it would have been a welcome element because I think, you know, she is beloved as a character, Queenie. I think she was, it was a literary sensation. I mean, she arrived as a character that's fully formed and like fizzed to life on the page. And you were going from, you know, crying with emotion to crying with laughter within, you know, the sentences. It was such an accomplished arrival. And I think because of those expectations we've all had about what would Queenie be like, how do you transfer this woman to the screen? It's a difficult ask, I think. And I also think, you know, 4 years have passed between the publication and they're 4 very big years, you know, post-COVID. And I think that is an element to, because if you're writing about young people, you know, sometimes you'll look at Lena Dunham's Girls and even though the writing is immaculate and perfect, there are elements where you're like, well, that's grounded it in a certain time. And they have tried to modernise it in a way, you know, injecting bits of pieces about TikTok and text language and things like that. But it does feel very different to what you would get on the page. And one of the main features of Queenie is the fact that it's internal monologue. And that's a very hard thing to bring to the screen, I think, as well.
So we'll play a clip and then I'll ask you to give us some of the story of Queenie. So in this clip, Queenie, Dionne Brown, chats about the hospital checkup. She's just been at a hospital checkup in the opening scene and she's met her Jamaican auntie, Maggie, and they have a chat about the checkup.
No, apparently my cervix is shallow, so it's just a lot of navigation. So
I've already told you, we do not talk about our V in public.
It's not my V, it's my cervix. And
this is what happens when you run around with Gemini Boy. You start talking explicitly in public, V this and V that, and no talk of G-O-D. You weren't raised that way.
Okay, when you say Gemini Boy, you mean white boy, don't you?
I cannot speak for your interpretations, Queenie. You know what I mean.
So we learn from that that the Queenie is going out with a white boy, that she has an extended Jamaican family. What's the guts of the story?
And basically, her boyfriend is asking to go on a break, and a significant break. Now, they've been long-term together. They're living together. So Queenie has to move out. She has to tell everybody in her life that they're on a break, and she doesn't really know where she stands. And is she single? Is this the bold new train that she's going to embark on? She's also in a job where she's underappreciated, undervalued. She feels like the diversity hire in a newspaper where her boss, who's played brilliantly by Sally Phillips, is not asking. She's, you know, Queenie wants to get involved with writing for the paper, but, you know, Sally Phillips' character is put off, and she feels very undermined and underutilized. So that's another, you know, point of sadness and frustration for Queenie. But she's also dealing with a lot of microaggressions in her life, like being a black woman of her age, moving around the world. She's, when she embarks on this kind of, goes on dating sites, and that's when it actually really shines for me, because she is having this self-destructive sex with these terrible, mostly white men, and her self-worth is plummeted, and her, you know, valuation of herself is nosediving, and it really digs into what it feels like to be treated as a sexualized object rather than a fully rounded human being. So, and that's on top of then dealing with her distresses within her family, her mental health issues. She's suffering with anxiety attacks because she has these abandonment issues when her mother left when she was very young.
So Chris, they've called this the Black Brit, or the Black British Bridget Jones style. Do you feel that it's got that light touch? Jen is talking about the internal monologue, and it is about modern day life, about relationships.
Yeah. I think that's probably, when I first saw that description, I thought that's a little bit unfair. But then I saw that Candace Carty-Jones, or Cardi Williams, actually came up with that description. And she was talking about the fact that when she was coming up as an author, Bridget Jones was this book that made an awful lot of noise, and it was in every household. And the way she saw it, she wanted Queenie in every household. And she succeeded in that. I think you're talking about like 250,000 copies sold in the UK alone. So the next phase then would be to bring it to television, and I think it works reasonably well with a few creaks. I mean, like, if you listen to the synopsis there, you'll realise that it's a busy story and that it's full of chaos, and the delivery is sometimes a little too chaotic. You know, it tries to cram an awful lot into these snappy 25 minute bursts. That's a good thing that we do have, that there is 8 25 minute episodes rather than hour long episodes, but it takes a while for it to settle. I think the reason you might stay with it is Dionne Brown. Her performance is wonderful. She's very good at playing, and we're seeing an awful lot of this on British television at the moment. These quarter life crisis comedy dramas, everything from Smothered to Big Mood. There are so many of them at the minute that yours has to be really special to stand out. I think Dionne Brown makes it special rather than the material. So it did work for me, but it is a bit creaky.
And stars out of 5 for you, Chris?
I think it's off to a promising start, so we'll go with 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5. And from you, Jen?
I mean, I feel that the material is there, but sadly it got lost in translation when you're transferring it onto the big screen or the screen. And I just think sometimes things are left better on the page. But I will say the characterisation of the family is brilliant. And her best friend, there's a singer called Bella, and she is magnetic as her best friend, Cheska. She's unbelievable. I think she's a rising star. And I do think Dionne Brown is fabulous. But for me, it would only be a 3, unfortunately.
3. So 2 threes out of 5 for Queenie, and that's on Channel 4 on Tuesdays. And finally, Disney Plus launches a new 6-part biopic tomorrow. Becoming Karl Lagerfeld stars Daniel Brühl as Lagerfeld and tells the story of the German fashion icon in a time prior to taking over as Chanel. It focuses on his rivalry, both professionally and in love matters, with Yves Saint Laurent. Wasn't this dealt with in Saint Laurent, the film? This actual period.
It probably was, yeah. But I think actually Lagerfeld is obviously the centre of attention. It's all focusing on him this time. And I like the fact straight away that it's not a cradle to the grave story. And it is becoming Karl Lagerfeld. It's showing us how he kind of, you know, got to his mid or late 30s in the 1970s and realised, I am not where I want to be and I'm going to shake things up. So it brings us right up until he became the artistic director at Chanel.
So he's freelance at this stage, and he's with Finn.
Yeah,
Indian Chloe.
He's with Chloe, and he is he's not quite the artistic director there at the time, and he's in more ready to wear than high fashion. And as a result of this, you have people like Yves Saint Laurent, who, you know, is a former very close friend, who kind of looks down on him because, you know, it's not haute couture, it's basically it's ready to wear fashion. So it's actually his encounter with a socialite and an aspiring writer named Jacques de Bachet, played by Theodore Pellerin, who longs to be in Karl Lagerfeld's world. He's a bit of a nobody, and he sees Karl Lagerfeld and he thinks, I'll have what he's having, you know, I want to be in that world. They form a little bit of a connection, and though you think that it might be a bit of a romance, it's actually a sexless romance. It's more of a Karl Lagerfeld just likes having him around, and he begins to finance his lifestyle, and he does like inject that spring into his step. He asks to be the artistic director of Chloe. He starts running these shows. He works up the courage to get in touch with Marta Dietrich, played brilliantly by Sonny Mills, and starts designing an outfit for her. So basically, this socialite brings out an awful lot of confidence in Karl Lagerfeld. But what he doesn't know, he'll find out eventually, is that, you know, his friend is having an affair with Yves Saint Laurent. So that kind of ruins everything.
That sounds very intriguing. High fashion and romance.
Yeah, I don't know. I found this whole concept hilarious to me, because Karl Lagerfeld spent his whole entire life attempting to be a mystery, to be an enigma, this unknowable quantity. And he was someone who carefully crafted this character of Kaiser Karl, with his ponytail, his sunglasses, his fan, his waspishness. And he used these, you know, to distract from getting a glimpse at like the real person. And it was this brilliant Warholian sleight of hand that he did for his entire life. Like, and it's a trick, like his designs, it's echoing those kind of frou-frou distractions of the creation of his clothes. And he wanted to keep everyone's at arm's length deliberately. And this Disney drama, it's focusing on the most kind of scurrilous events of his early years in a way.
And is he a likeable character?
He never was. I don't think that's the point of Karl Lagerfeld. I think he's one of the most fascinating characters of, you know, the 20th and 21st century. Like, he really is. And there will be nobody like him ever again, because they won't be allowed to be like him or behave in the way that he did because of consequence culture. I mean, I think he was right to exit stage left when he did. Like, his death was timely in that way. It ends that era. But I think it would be
because of his views
on immigration, on women's bodies. He was a complete body fascist. He said, you know, on Channel 4 News one time, he's like, I'm so sad that women will be fat in the future. You know, those kind of things. And his comments about immigration are, you know, disgraceful. And he also has this very shady past, like a mysterious past of it. You know, his parents were both involved with the Nazi party, and that's how they survived in Germany. That's really interesting. This person who is like the person that he's made up to be, or pretended not to be, or tried to move away from, where is that story? And I don't think this is not a puff piece. It's not trying to lionize Lagerfeld as a character or even dismantle the myth. So it's creating a new myth, and it's not even getting closer to the man at all, which I found really, really strange. And I thought the depiction of Yves Saint Laurent was ridiculous. It's one of the titans, a genius of, you know, fashion. Like, these two men changed the face of fashion, and to have them look like they're arguing over this basically a courtesan reduced them, I think, to nothing. You don't see why these men were so important. You get a flash of the YSL tuxedo, the women's tuxedo, that's so iconic, but you don't get to know why Karl Lagerfeld himself, why did he, you know, ascend to Chanel?
There's no lovely cutting scenes of clothes.
Not
or
really, no. You don't understand why he became so famous, or why Chanel wanted him for the job. You know, it ends, like, as I said, it's like the decade before Chanel came a knocking. But surely, for me, he recreated Fendi with the Fendi furs. He was the man to put them on this level, on a map, you know, at the time. Yes, he was a hired hand, you know, a gun for hire, essentially, but he made his name through that. And you don't really see that enough.
And you kind of feel sometimes as if you're coming in halfway through a series. I think you need to set the board or properly with a series like this. You need to properly introduce the players, introduce the worlds, explain why there is that rivalry in the first place. But a lot of the time, characters are wandering in and out of rooms, and we're supposed to maybe, you know, be taken aback by who they are, but we don't know who they are because the show doesn't really explain it to us. So it is a bit of a shame. And I did have problems. I was quite conflicted about Brühl's performance as Lagerfeld, because Brühl is such a good actor and he is very good here, but he's making a sympathetic, friendly figure out of a guy who could drop the temperature in the room. You know, he wasn't that likable in real life.
From Rush, obviously. previously,
and
All Quiet on the Western Front.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So he is a tremendous actor, and there are some, and he's surrounded by other tremendous actors here. But the series is a bit too soapy and stagey.
Okay, stars out of five.
It's 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5 from you, Jen.
Yeah, 2 out of 5, and I'd say for people who are interested in the legend of Karl Lagerfeld, just watch the 2007 documentary Lagerfeld Confidential,
which is where
which is it? It's on Mubi, I think, right now.
Okay, or this for Disney Plus. Jen Cannon and Chris Foster, thank you very much. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. In 1936, author George Orwell went to the Spanish Civil War as an enthusiastic supporter of the socialist dream and a hater of fascism. He returned injured and disillusioned. He wrote about his Civil War experience in Homage to Catalonia and later stated that every line of serious work that I have written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism, as I understand it. This fear of totalitarianism led to maybe his greatest novel, 1984, which he wrote in 1949, a year before his death. I'm delighted to be joined by Darrell Jones to look back at 1984. Darrell, George Orwell definitely did live in interesting times, experiencing the British colonial world when he was stationed in Burma, then the fight between socialism and fascism on the front line during the Spanish Civil War. When did he hone his views on socialism and communism and totalitarianism?
So Orwell, Eric Arthur Blair, as he was born, was a man of the left. And he was also a member of the English establishment. He was educated in Eton in the Great English Public School. His father was in the colonial service. He himself became a military policeman in Burma. So he had first-hand experience of the British Empire and of the structures of British power, did not like what he saw. And particularly, I think, his time in Burma, working as a military policeman, gave him what he described himself as a bad conscience. So he comes back from Burma. He drops out. He lives amongst the down and outs in Paris and London. Writes down and outs in Paris and London. Begins to make a name for himself as a novelist and a writer and an essayist. Invents a pseudonym, but also persona of George Orwell. George Orwell is and is not Eric Blair. And being George Orwell enabled him to say things more directly than he otherwise would. Orwell is very much a man of the left, as I said, and very much also a man of immense sympathy with the victims of the Depression, the victims of the Empire, the victims of capitalism, the victims of fascism. So in 1936, he enlists in the forces fighting fascism in the Spanish Civil War, and finds himself living and fighting amongst a group of anarchists, the party of Marxist unification, they were called. So these were not communists. And he's there on the front lines, and he gets shot in the throat.
But he didn't have any problem at that stage about communists.
Oh, absolutely not. No. And I'm not sure he quite knew what he was getting himself into and who he was fighting with. And this is one of the things that you get from reading Homage to Catalonia, is this great sense of it's frontline reporting, and it's also reporting of it's very partial and often very confused. What's going on here? Who are these people? What am I doing here? What's happening now? I have no idea. He gets shot. He gets shot in the throat. Returns to Barcelona, the capital of Catalonia, and finds the city in a state of war, but not the war he thought he was fighting, because by this time the communists, or the Stalinists very particularly, and other radical forces, the anarchists, have turned on one another. And so what he sees is people who he thought were on his side fighting against him and fighting against his comrades. And so some of his friends, some of his comrades get imprisoned by the Stalinists and the communists. And he returns to England at the end of that book. We see him sitting on a railway carriage, thinking a war is coming. And this is England. This England needs to be protected. And it needs to be protected from fascism, it does, but from totalitarianism of all kinds.
Because he could see that the Stalinists he met in the trenches at the Spanish Civil War were being controlled by Moscow.
That's right, yes. Mm. It's a complicated and, for him, often quite a delicate line that he treads between socialism and democratic socialism, as I understand it, as he says, and a version of socialism that would work in England, and a horror of the possibilities of totalitarianism, the possibilities of total war, and a horror of all kinds of systematic political ideologies, both of the left and of the right.
And then, so he would have wrote Animal Farm after he came back from the Civil War. And then I suppose that is the machinations of how a totalitarian regime can come about. But then 1984 is about living in it and living under it. So how did it come about?
So he writes Animal Farm, as you suggest, which is an allegory. And as his friend, the poet and critic William Empson, said to Orwell, you know, the thing about allegories is they mean more than their authors think that they mean. And so he found himself, or the book has found itself, interpreted in various ways that Orwell himself did not necessarily intend. T.S. Eliot, who read Animal Farm for Faber and Faber, he was the commissioning editor for Faber and Faber, they chose not to publish it because it was felt to be an attack on Stalinist Russia and on Stalin, who was at this time the ally of the British during the war. So it was felt to be running counter to the war effort. But T.S. Eliot thought that the moral of Animal Farm was that it was quite right that the pigs should be in charge, because the pigs were very clearly more intelligent than the other animals, and so they were the kind of natural aristocrats, and of course they should be in charge.
He had to have another go.
So he did. And so he finds himself writing out of the experience of, what would happen if all of the things that I've been fearing and worrying about, if the bombs started to drop on England, if the totalitarians took over, what would England look like? What would the country that I love look like? Of course, the thing about 1984 is that he was writing it in 1948. So it is simultaneously this horrific version of a dystopian future, but also a version of the English present of 1948, with its scarcity and its austerity and its deprivations and its bombed out London, that all of his readers would have recognised and understood. And so, you know, this is, well, what would a totalitarian England really look like?
So we meet Winston Smith, who is the protagonist of the book, and he's like a civil servant. Mm. But the world he lives in is a completely observed world, a world where he can have no privacy, hardly even in his thoughts.
That's right. Today we'd call it a surveillance state. His movements and everyone's movements, in fact, are tracked. They're tracked through surveillance equipment, through recording devices and screens in everyone's homes and at everyone's work, but also through a community of willing spies. Children will inform on their parents, for example, so that privacy and the internal life is something which the state very much sets out to regulate, and it's part of a number of repressive, all interlinked repressive mechanisms. Language itself, the party which runs the state, is rewriting the English language according to the principles of Newspeak, getting rid of words, refining down the language so that multiple interpretations are no longer possible. Each word can only mean one thing, and this in turn restricts the possibilities for thought.
Because Winston's own job is about editing the past, isn't it?
It is. So he's a functionary, he's a bureaucrat, he's a civil servant. He works in the Ministry of Truth. His job is to edit and rewrite the past when political ideas change, when political opinions change, when figures fall out of favour, for example, as certainly happened in Stalinist Russia, they need to be removed from history. And so he rewrites newspaper articles, he doctors photographs, and the discarded version of the past he places in the memory hole where it's forgotten about. It's not even forgotten about. It never happened. So he rewrites the past. That is his job.
So I suppose he's what happens is the Winston makes friends. Mm. He has a lover and he has a best friend because he presumably that human need for communication and for emotion.
Mm. Yes, so he develops very close, actually very intimate relationships with two people in the novel. One is Julia, a young woman whom he first encounters in a 2 minutes hate, where the party members get together and get all the rage, get it out of their system, they express it, and he sees this young woman, and they develop a relationship because one of the things, of course, that's regulated and very strictly controlled by the state is. One's emotional life, one's romantic life, one's sexual life, desire, and the potentially revolutionary and unruly energies of desire are very strictly controlled. He has an illicit clandestine affair which he conducts in a room that they rent above an antiques shop with Julia, while at the same time he develops what he thinks of as a kind of bond, but again, a very close relationship with O'Brien. And O'Brien is a very powerful, very senior member of the inner party. So he has direct access to Big Brother, the totalitarian leader. He may even be Big Brother. We're never quite sure whether Big Brother exists, whether Big Brother is O'Brien, whether he's a composite figure. But O'Brien is also a double of Winston himself. And Winston thinks that the pair of them understand one another. And he even comes to think that O'Brien might himself be a kind of secret revolutionary, secretly working against the state. This turns out to be a very big mistake.
All the words you say there, like Big Brother, hate speak, new speak,
double think, all of these things, yes.
All of these things come from 1984.
They do. Yes, yes, the memory hole, the very concept of something being Orwellian, which means that it's it's involved in a complex and contradictory and labyrinthine set of political rules and regulations. All of these come from 1984. The memory hole itself, doublethink, the idea that one can simultaneously know something and not know something, which is, something that we all practice every day. All of these things come from 1984.
And he wrote this, as we said, in 1949. Mm. So this was at the end of the war when fascism may have been dead at that stage, or at least beaten. But there was communism, and then there was the democratic world of the West. But there was strong feelings, pro-feelings, about communism and socialism. So how did this go down amongst the intellectuals and the wider readership?
This is one of the fascinating things for me about Orwell. And one of the reasons I genuinely think he is a vital and living writer still, is that he manages to annoy, alienate all sides of the political spectrum. The right have at various points intensely hated him because he's very avowedly a man of the left. He was very, very avowedly one of the most trenchant critics the British Empire ever had. The left are, if anything, often even more scathing towards Orwell because of his anti-communism. Because, as I said earlier, he tried to steer this often quite idiosyncratic course between, a kind of English patriotism and English socialism, but not a kind of communism. Many, particularly in the 40s and 50s, many left-wing intellectuals, and I think the body of intellectual thought, certainly in Britain at the time, probably did belong in the left, was very often violently opposed to Orwell. And, it became known that, for example, he had released the names of or disclosed the names of communist activists to the British government in the last years of his life. Now, this is a very complicated thing. It takes us back, I think, to Orwell's own direct lived experience of what Stalinists actually did during the Spanish Civil War, and also what we now know about the horrors of life under Stalinism. So it's a very complicated issue. And as always with Orwell. He's a very, very self-divided figure, and that's one of the things that makes him so fascinating. You can never quite pin him down. But certainly, right up to my own sort of teens, Animal Farm and most definitely 1984 were understood. These were novels of the Cold War.
Big Brother, Room 101, which we didn't touch on, but that, of course, is where the whole story is leading up to this room of personal horrors.
Yes.
What do you think about the way it's been embraced in popular culture? You know, and sometimes the message, clearly difficult intellectual and political questions he was trying to tease out and find a path through between totalitarianism and not fascism, but maybe capitalism. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what Orwell would have made of this. He writes a very famous essay called Politics in the English Language, in which he warns against being spoken through by other people's language. And you can very clearly see that Newspeak, that's what's happening there. The dangers or the possibilities that language can think your thoughts for you, that you're being spoken through by a language that is not your own. And so he was at the same time quite fascinated by popular culture and, you know, quite disturbed by the possibilities of popular culture and its use of advertising slogans, for example, of propaganda, of cliches. I mean, propaganda is a form of art that only says one thing, and that's a very dangerous form of art. So he was quite skeptical about popular culture while being fascinated by it. But he was also as much as any other writer that I can think of was a man with a real genius for a resonant phrase, the ones that we've been talking about, the ones that we are still using now. So it's in some way, it's testimony to his great power and appeal as a writer that we are still using phrases like Big Brother, like Room 101. But it's also that literature means things that its writers could not possibly have intended.
When you're teaching this book, you're obviously enthusiastic and think it's a great novel. How do you find your students taking it now?
They read it in the context of, often, of modern surveillance culture. Whereas for me at 18, it was a novel about the Cold War. It was a nuclear novel. It's a novel that starts with a bomb, the nuclear war, and society breaks down in the aftermath of the nuclear war. And that's what it was about, you know. So as I was watching it, you know, I was worried about the possibility of nuclear annihilation. For my students now, a generation and more down the line, this is a novel that tells them things about how their entire life is lived publicly, how modern society willingly discloses all its secrets, how the sense that there is a private sphere or a sense of private communication has broken down, but also the ways in which we are complicit in our own surveillance, our own self-surveillance in this way. We voluntarily scroll through Twitter or do whatever it is we do with TikTok while simultaneously knowing and not knowing in that double think way that this is not good for us. This is not the good life that we are leading here. There's a famous, Winston Smith has a dream quite early on in the novel in which a voice, which turns out to be the voice of O'Brien, says to him, "We shall meet in the place where there is no darkness." And this can mean a whole lot of things. It can mean paradise, it can mean heaven, it can mean enlightenment, but it can also mean, and turns out to mean, the torture chambers of the party in the Ministry of Love, where the lights shine, the electric lights shine all day. But it can also mean, you know, a place of complete visibility, a place of complete surveillance, where, you know, even, as Winston himself says, even the very few cubic centimetres inside your head, which may be the only private space that you have, even those are not your own anymore. When all of our activities, all of our desires, all of our curiosities are there to be marketized, or worse than marketized. That's the kind of anxieties that I think my students see coming out of 1984.
Well, Darrell Jones, thank you so much for bringing us back into George Orwell's 1984, which is 75 years today. Kishok is the Irish word that can mean a shambles and a mess, or it can mean to improvise a pathway towards a solution. It's also the name of a new dance piece by Catherine Young. Kishok, an embodied manifesto, is a piece for six dancers that depicts their journey and relationship with the land. And choreographer Catherine Young joins me now in studio. Catherine, you're very welcome. Like in your work, in your past work, Kishok involves a lot of research into our relationships, in this case with the land. And you've done a lot of travelling in the research for this piece. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I guess the inspiration from the piece came from maybe three places. Usually when I'm making work, I'm responding to the world around me and what's going on. And I had finished a piece in relation to Palestine, and then I'd worked with people in direct provision. And I was wondering why I wasn't tackling the biggest crisis of our time, which is the climate crisis. And it felt somewhat overwhelming. And at the same time, I'd been reading a beautiful book called Braiding Sweetgrass by a Native American environmental biologist, Robin Wall Kimmerer. And she talked a lot about, in order to restore our relationship with the land, in order to restore the land, we have to restore our relationship with it. I travel a lot to Africa. I've been studying West African dance for about 20 years, and I go try and go every second year. And when I'm there, I'm really struck by the relationship people have with the land. In the particular village that I go to, the food you eat is coming from the ground. The fish is coming from the sea that day. The animals are wandering around. Nothing is fenced in. So you really feel that sense of that you're part of nature. You're part of it. And the relationship's very strong. And then, you know, in the West, it feels that we've lost a little bit of that connection. And when you've lost a connection, you can other things, and you can destroy things. So the kind of first step for me in looking at this topic was, how do we repair that relationship and come closer to nature? And we actually are nature, and sometimes we see it as something outside of ourselves.
And in those experiences you had in Africa and Palestine, were the people very in their cultural practices then? Were they very involved with the land?
Yeah, I think the land seems to be at the centre of nearly all the work I make. I think it seems to be the root of all our ills. A big thing for me also is the connection of culture and music and dance to the land and the importance of it in these different cultures. There's in West Africa, there's rhythms for everything, whether it's births, deaths, harvest, fishing, and there's ceremonies that go with this. Likewise, in Palestine, Dabka dance is it's a form of cultural resistance. So music and dance plays a really, really strong role. And maybe as an artist, I love the idea that music and dance and storytelling is at the centre of a culture, that it's not kind of on the periphery like it can be in our cultures, and that it functions really importantly in societies.
Okay, well, we'll talk about how you've put this into the Irish context. So let's listen to a piece of music, Amargen. This is by Micheál Ódóvgal and also Jess Kavanagh.
Erimulor mugo
Niall O'Dool there singing Amargan, and Jess Kavanagh performs in other parts of your show. So this is the first time in a long time that you have had your work about Ireland, and very much about Ireland in this, because it's about the very land itself.
Yeah, and I've been really fascinated by other cultures and studying the dance forms of nearly every other culture. I didn't grow up doing Irish dance, so in making the show, it really made me go back to the land here, you know, the land that I'm standing on. I had also read Malcolm McGann's beautiful books as well. And there's so much richness in our own culture. So it felt that if I was making a piece about my own relationship, the land, that I had to start here. So we went back to the Song of Amargan, which is said to be one of the first poems in the Irish language. It was invoked by Amargan, who came to, was one of the first Celt to arrive in Ireland, I think, in 1700 BC. So his poem invokes the land of Ireland. And the key meaning behind it is he talks about the interconnectedness of all things, which I think is really, I guess, at the heart of everything. So we, Micheál worked with the old Irish version of the poem. He put the music to it. And then as we move through the show and the different manifesto points that we have come up with in relation to the topic, there's kind of an Amargan 2.0 that he sings at the end of the show in modern Irish.
And what will we see?
What will you see? You'll see a lot of movement. There's six dancers and six musicians. The show, like all my work, is highly energetic, but there's also a calmness in parts of it, because it is this journey about reconnecting to soul, to self, to each other, and to the natural world.
And you did a lot of rehearsals in bare feet on the land.
We were rehearsing the last 3 weeks in a beautiful place called Shawbrook in Longford. It's a dance studio in a forest. So every day we would do part of our rehearsals and our research outside, and we did some mindful walking, which is a practice of walking barefoot outside and slowing down. So I guess in order for us to really be dancing the themes of the show, we had to actually embody it and reconnect with the nature ourselves.
And did you build your choreography then based on those experiences? Is that how it goes?
The choreography comes from a lot of different sources. So we'll get in the room, we'll improvise outside. Some of it will be in response to ideas, some will be in response to text, some in response to music. So the dancers are amazing collaborators to work with. So a lot of material has come up, and then we craft it. You know, I work with a dramaturg, Hannah Slatner, so she'd be a central collaborator on the work in terms of how we shape the work and how we frame the work, yeah.
And that music, that beautiful music that we heard now, is that the type of music that is it all of a piece?
No, that's just one part of one piece. Yeah, so the music, it spans, I won't give too much away, but there's probably something for everyone in there. It spans from electronica to contemporary music too. And that particular part has the vestiges of Irishness, because it felt that needed to come into the work because of I guess my own journey and my own reconnection. And it felt really important to have the Irishness in there. A big thing is the connection of land to language, especially in Ireland. And I think one of the reasons we've lost our connection to the land is because we've lost the language. And in Malcolm's books, you really see that relationship in terms of how places are described. When you see the Irish name of it, it's so clear about what that place might look like. So for me, it was really important to have the language in there and to have some Irish music in there as well.
Now, and you're opening in Longford and then coming to Dublin, but it's in an ordinary theatre where it's not an outside piece.
No, and that was one of the things. We had two research periods over the last 2 years, and that was one of the things that became really clear to me. I knew the show was going to be indoors, so that kind of changed the nature of what I could say. If I was to make a piece about climate change per se, I think it would have to be out in nature. So I was really conscious of it, that it was going inside. It wasn't going to be in nature, even though we have a bit of nature on stage with us. But then it became clear that it had to be about humans and the human relationship, and that's the angle of the show.
Well, Catherine Young, it sounds fascinating. You can watch a preview of Kishok, an embodied manifesto, at the Backstage Theatre in Longford on Saturday the 15th of June. It premieres at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin, where it will show on 3 dates from Thursday the 20th to Saturday the 22nd of June. More information can be found from catherineyoungdance.com. Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kate.
That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Barbara Rose. Danwo. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Ali Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.